Good evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone. Welcome. I'm Pastor Tim Westermeyer, privileged to serve as the senior pastor here at St. Philip the Deacon, which is also privileged to host these wonderful community events called the Faith and Life Lecture Series. We are at the concluding speech or talk of the 23rd season of Faith and Life. So welcome to each and every one of you. Whether you're here in the sanctuary or whether you're joining us digitally, welcome to all of you. I do like to ask at the outset here if anyone is here for the first time. If you are, you could raise your hand. So, okay, lovely. Quite a few of you. Welcome to all of you. Glad to have you with us. For a little history, for 23 years, we've invited speakers from across the country and around the world who are Christian to come and talk about how the Christian faith informs whatever it is they happen to do in life. The vast majority of them are not theologically trained. They're not pastors or theologians. They come from the world of business or the academy or journalism, or they're authors or maybe artists. And they come to share, you know, the way their faith informs their work. There's not a particular theme to the series beyond that, nor is there a theme to each and every year. That said, I was doing a little bit of looking at the back catalog of our speakers now for 23 years, and the topic for tonight, which is faith and science, has actually been, if I did my math correctly, I think 11 of our 115 speakers have been either doctors or scientists and have addressed faith and science in some way. So that has, in fact, been one of the major themes that we've addressed, and I don't apologize for that because it turns out it's a really important one for our culture. I'll say more about our speaker tonight along those lines in a moment. Before I do, just a word about the flow for the evening. After I'm done introducing him, he will come up, he'll talk for 40, 45 minutes. After that, this is important, you will all have a chance to ask questions, and that's true whether you're here in the sanctuary or whether you're joining us digitally. If you're here in the sanctuary, you can go to a mic to my right or to the left and ask a question. If you are at home watching this, feel free to send a question either in the video that you're watching. There should be a box that allows you to submit a question, or you can email a question to the following email address, social@spdlc.org. So social@spdlc.org, and we'll have a chance after the talk to enjoy all of that Q&A. So I had to write this down because tonight's speaker is so accomplished that I didn't want to leave anything out. We are just delighted to have him. So he's a physician scientist. He has discovered genes associated with a number of diseases. He was the 16th director of the National Institutes of Health. He served in that role from 2009 to 2021 under three different presidents from both parties, importantly. He was the second director of the National Human Genome Research Institute. That was 93 to 2008. Again, two separate presidents of both parties. He has been elected, among other things, to the Institute of Medicine, the National Academy of Sciences, the Royal Society, and the Pontifical Academy of Science. He has received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the National Medal of Science, and he is the founder of something called the BioLogos Foundation, which promotes discourse between science and religion, speaking of which, Christine Torjesen is the current CEO and president of that, and she joins us tonight as one of his special guests. So welcome to you, Christine, as well. We're glad you're here. In addition to that, and you can find all of that out on his Wikipedia page or his bio, I always like to add at least one or two other interesting facts about our speaker. So one of those, and by the way, you can read an interview that we did with him on the St. Philip the Deacon website under our Inspire magazine. You can find that, a digital copy of that. And in that interview, among other things, you will discover that he loves to ride Harley-Davidson motorcycles. I think it's plural. Yeah. Later tonight, you will discover another interest of his, but I'm not going to spoil that. The other thing I will tell you, though, about him, and he's probably in a good state of the country given this, is that he is not a fan of spicy food. Will you join me in welcoming Dr. Francis Collins?
Thank you. Well, thank you, Pastor, for that very kind introduction and spilling all of those secrets. And it's wonderful to be here at St. Philip the Deacon Lutheran Church in a very impressive series that has been going on here over these 23 years. And Tim is telling me he's the guy that started this when you were about 17, I guess. And the lineup of people who have preceded me is truly impressive. So I hope I'm not going to wreck the record here this evening. But I'm really going to be interested to hear what you all have to put forward when we get to the time for the questions. So let's be thinking about those things as the presentation goes forward. And you do see up here on my opening slide a mention of BioLogos. And I'm glad that Tim already introduced Dr. Torjesson, our president and CEO, who has been overseeing this enterprise for the last year. And I'll say a bit more about BioLogos in the course of the presentation. And I think many of you who are looking for a really thoughtful discourse about how rigorous Christian faith and rigorous science can get along, BioLogos is a really good place to use as a resource. And I will tap into some of those things in the course of the next little bit. So what are you in for? Well, I always think it's good to tell people what's coming. So tonight's presentation is going to go like this. We're going to start off with a little bit of a journey of my own in science to tell you how it is that these things that were mentioned actually happened despite anything that I would have actually planned. And then how did I become to be a Christian? And spoiler alert, I wasn't born that way. In fact, I was an atheist when I was in graduate school. And then, okay, how do you put those things together, Dr. Collins? How can you actually say that you're both a scientist and a Christian? And how did your head not explode when you tried to put those two things together? Then I'm going to talk a bit about a concern of mine right now, which is the state of our nation and our world and the degree to which we seem to have become so divided and polarized about a lot of things. A place where people of faith ought to be in a good position to be peacemakers and healers, but it hasn't been so easy. Some reflections on what happened and maybe something about what we might do to find our way back to a place that's more, I think, in concert with what God had hoped his communities would look like. And then we'll get to the audience Q&A. So that's what you're in for. Here we go. My own journey in science started rather unimpressively. That's me. I think I'm about 7 or 8. And that's the farm where I grew up in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. I did not go to school until the 6th grade, not for religious reasons, but because my parents thought they were better teachers than the local county schools. And so they taught me and my 3 older brothers at home, which was quite an undertaking. But I was so gifted to have that experience because the thing my parents were most interested in was to get you excited about learning something new. I don't recall that there were lesson plans. It was like, okay, what's interesting today? Let's talk about that. And maybe it would be math. And sometimes it might be math for 3 days in a row with no breaks because it was interesting. And then you hit a wall. Okay, let's do something else. Let's decide we're going to read Charles Dickens today and see what we can learn from that. And then there would be art and there would be theater. My father was a drama professor. My mother was a playwright. There had to be theater. I got shoved on the stage at the age of 5 and actually kind of loved that too. And then there was music. My dad had been a folk song collector in the late 1930s in North Carolina and knew a lot of the original folk song folks from that era. And so growing up, I had to learn to play an instrument. Otherwise, I would not be having much fun at my house. So yes, the guitar was something I picked up along the way and hoped it would do something to deal with my otherwise very nerdy personality, because what happened next was I got interested in science. And it was fortunate for me that I had this homeschooling for the first 6 grades. And then we moved in town and I got to go to a very good public school in Stanton, Virginia. And there in the 10th grade, I met science, or science met me, or the teacher, John House, figured out how to inspire me and most of the other people in that class, some of whom have gone on to be significant leaders in the field of chemistry, why science is so exciting. It's a detective story. You use these tools of science, there's an answer out there somewhere, you're going to figure it out, you're going to make a discovery. And yeah, sometimes it doesn't go the way you want it to, and you get the wrong answer, and you have to figure out it was the wrong answer, but it's going to ultimately bring you to something you could call truth about how things work. And I thought that's what I want to do, so I decided I would major in chemistry at the University of Virginia. Having loved that, I would go off and get a PhD in chemistry at Yale University. But the chemistry I was doing was pretty abstract. And it took a little while before I realized that I kind of missed out on a very exciting area of science called biology. Because biology seemed kind of messy. Well, frankly, it is, but it's also really interesting. And I discovered rather late in this whole process that the most interesting chemical is this one, DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. Here you see spilling out of the nucleus of a cell. This information molecule is chemistry. It is the way in which information is carried by all living organisms. It is the way in which that's passed from parents to children, all encoded within that molecule, which has a language, a very simple language. It has only four letters in its alphabet. They're actually chemical bases, and we abbreviate them ACGT, and people are always upset that we didn't just call them ABCD, but never mind. It's ACGT. And that molecule, whose DNA double helix structure was figured out by Watson and Crick back in 1953, has just opened our eyes to the magic of how life works. And misspellings in that can then cause diseases like sickle cell disease or cystic fibrosis. And we are now figuring out, as I'll come to in a minute, how to actually uncover those things. So this was captivating. I had missed out somehow on realizing what an amazing kind of science was going on that was a little different than my quantum mechanics. And so I had to do something. And I decided to make a big switch. And somehow the admissions committee at the University of North Carolina thought that was a good enough reason for me to be allowed to come to their medical school, which is what I did. And I fell in love right away with the idea, this is science, but it's fascinating. It's sort of digital science, but it's about people. And something's going to be happening here somehow in my lifetime where this won't just be abstract. It might actually start to lead to some real breakthroughs. So I did all that training. It went on a while. I finally got a real job at the University of Michigan. And my initial projects were to try to use the tools of DNA to discover the causes of diseases that we knew were inherited, but we didn't know what gene was misspelled. And this was in the 1980s, where we knew very little about our own DNA. We knew there was a lot of it. We had little islands here and there where we had actually sampled it, and we could actually read out a few of the letters. But mostly, we were in the dark. And so if you were going to try to find the cause of a disease like cystic fibrosis, which was the one that my lab started working on in 1985, you had a very tough problem ahead of you because of the scale and the ignorance of what you were dealing with. And after a few years of working on that and having people say, "Don't you have it yet?" I finally decided I needed a metaphor. So I found a haystack outside of Ann Arbor. And I went there with my lab coat and a needle that I could hold up and say, "Okay, do you get it? It's like a needle in a haystack. That's what I'm trying to do. That's why we don't have the answer yet." And yes, those are real chickens in the haystack too. And they were not very friendly. But ultimately, with a lot of hard work and a lot of wonderful collaborators that I got to work with, we ultimately began to succeed. And in 1989, the gene emerged that is the cause of cystic fibrosis. That was a big moment. It was the first time we had actually discovered at the DNA level the precise misspelling that causes a disease like cystic fibrosis. Just three letters missing, a CTT dropping out in the middle of this gene on chromosome 7, that was the main cause of this disease. And that was a big moment of hope that this is now going to lead to some better answers for kids with this disease, who at that point survived, if all went well, maybe to teenage years, but rarely much beyond that. I'm glad I can tell you now here in 2026, although it took another 35, 36 years to get there. If you have that three base pair misspelling in that gene, if you have two copies of it or even one copy of it, you now have a therapy available to you that's going to allow you not to plan your funeral, but to plan your retirement. That's what is possible. But that took all those years to get there. An important point that I think not everybody realizes that an initial discovery that is going to ultimately lead to some clinical benefit, you've got a ton of work to do. And the work, for the most part, is done in universities, funded by you, the taxpayers, through the National Institutes of Health, through investigators who write their most compelling grant proposals that get put through the most rigorous peer review system in the world. And then, if you're lucky, 20% of the time, you actually get the grant and you go and do the work. And that's why America has led the world in biomedical research for the last 30 or 40 years, that system. And then once a discovery is made in a university, it looks like it might lead to an actual clinical benefit, then it gets licensed out to a company that moves it forward all the way to the point of FDA approval. That's our ecosystem. It's been the envy of the world. I'm sorry to tell you right now, and I'll come back to this, it's in trouble, especially in the last year and a half, where this momentum is at serious difficulty of having been slowed down. And I think for people who are dreaming of the next breakthrough in cancer or Alzheimer's, this is something to worry about and something to try to set right again. Well, back to cystic fibrosis and me in the 1980s at Michigan. Yes, I worked on some other diseases, Huntington's disease. We found the gene for that. That's Nancy Wexler, who is such a leader in that field. This is a little boy with neurofibromatosis, which is another inherited disorder that is actually fairly common but doesn't get much attention. We found the cause of that. And then for the last 25 years, I've worked on this disease called progeria, the rarest form of premature aging. That boy, that's Sam Burns there between me and Cookie Monster, and that boy is 15 years old at that point, and you can tell he looks like a very old man. And sadly, he died about a year later of a heart attack. And then most kids with this die of heart attacks and strokes because their bodies are aging at about 7 times the normal rate, even though their minds are developing normally. And it's one of the more heartbreaking circumstances to see this happening. And I'm happy to say we have made some real progress in this. And now these kids are sometimes living into their 20s. And within a few months, we will run the very first trial of something called gene editing to try to fix, in a child like this, that one letter that's misspelled. In this case, it's a T that should have been a C in a vulnerable place in a particular gene. For me to be able to say to you that we might actually be able to fix that with gene editing, I could not have said that 10 years ago without laughing at myself because it seemed so improbable. But that's the way in which progress is going here. So I was having a good time in Ann Arbor doing all this, and then the Genome Project was being talked about. So what's that? The idea was, if we're really going to do a good job of finding the genetic basis of all these thousands of disorders, including some that are much more complicated, we need to have a reference copy of our own DNA so we don't have to keep looking into the dark places to try to see what's there. And that was the Human Genome Project. Let's get together and do that. Most of the scientific community in 1990 was opposed to that. They thought it was going to be sort of a fool's errand. It was going to cost way too much. It would be a technological failure, and the money would be better spent in other places. But some of us felt like we just got to do this, and there was enough momentum to get the Congress to go along with that idea. And so I got asked to lead this effort in 1993 and continued that for the next 10 years with a whole lot of things that had to happen along the way, because when we started out, we nowhere near had the kind of technology we needed to read 3 billion letters of the human genome. That's the number, 3 billion. Each one of your cells has 3 billion letters of DNA from mom and 3 billion from dad, so that's a total of 6 billion. And every time that cell divides, you got to copy the whole thing, and it would not be good to make mistakes. It's an amazing system. And you're just doing that right now without having to think about it. If you imagine printing out the human genome, nobody's done that in a hard copy yet, I don't think. But imagine that you did. And let's be reasonable with the font size and the margins and the thickness of the paper. And then pile those on top of each other from one cell. How tall would it be? It's about the same height as the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. Your cell, each cell is carrying that around. Isn't that astounding? Some people say science takes all the awe out of things. Heck no, this is like bringing awe to the forefront. So we struggled pretty hard with this effort, and I would say the first few years of the Genome Project, I worried about having to give the speech that said we're giving up, but we never had to give that speech because it began to pick up momentum, and ultimately we succeeded. 2,500 scientists, 20 research institutions, 6 countries, 13 years. It was my job to lead this enterprise, but boy, did I have an amazing group of friends and scientists to work on this. And then we were able to say, we have it. We've crossed a bridge into new territory where we know our own DNA instruction book. We don't have to go back to the place where we don't know. What's happened since then? A whole lot. Certainly, if anybody in this place is dealing with a cancer, as I am, I have prostate cancer, you want to know everything you can about that particular cancer in terms of what misspelling in DNA caused those good cells to go bad. And now we can actually go and look. Just look at your tumor and say, okay, where is the misspelling? And that might be the best clue as to what of the various interventions that might work, what is most likely to work. You'd call that precision medicine as opposed to one size fits all. Precision medicine is happening now in a big way, but it's going to happen even more in the coming years as we get better at this. Well, then I got called back to the NIH after I thought I was done with all of this. To come back and serve as the director of the whole thing. So NIH is made up of 27 institutes and centers. Only one of them was about the genome. I had to learn about the other 26, and I had to figure out how do you steer this enterprise when there's so many scientific opportunities? Where are there places where a nudge might be able to move things faster or bring together scientists who normally don't meet because maybe these are engineers and these are biologists and, you know, put them into the same collaboration and see what happens. That was a lot of my job. And over 12 years, it was an amazing experience. I started a new center to try to move basic science discoveries into the clinic. We started a whole program on the human brain, which is now 10 years along. And oh my gosh, the mysteries that we are beginning to discover in this effort to figure out what's going on with those 86 billion neurons between your ears. You have the most elaborate, complex structure in the known universe in your head. Nothing else comes close. And to be able to say we're going to figure that out is pretty bold. Some people worried at first that our brains are not complicated enough to understand our brains. But I think with AI we'll be all right. We'll figure it out. And that's making progress that is ultimately going to lead us to brand new understandings of things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and schizophrenia and all kinds of mental illnesses as well. We started a program which has enrolled almost 1 million Americans in a long-term study of precision health. They have their genome sequenced. You can do that, by the way, now for about $100. That first one cost $400 million, so that's a pretty good discount. And they fill out all kinds of questionnaires. They make their medical records available, carefully anonymized. And researchers are learning all kinds of things about genetics, environment, and what keeps people healthy, and what to do if they happen to start to develop an illness. And gene therapy, which had been a dream of mine going back to my training, has begun to work. Sickle cell disease, that first molecular disease caused by one letter that's misspelled, a T that should have been an A, and a gene for human hemoglobin, is now curable. Curable. These people have suffered so much from these agonizing pain episodes, which is part of sickle cell disease, and live short lives. And now one can actually fix the genetic problem by modifying their bone marrow and then giving it back to them. And they are living completely new lives. You can't help but get excited and inspired when you see something like that. And then I ended up spending a year in the White House as the acting science advisor to the president. And that was an interesting experience also to look at science from a somewhat different perspective. Because when I was at NIH, what I always tried to do is keep the White House out of what we were doing. And now I'm the guy in the White House going to NIH, hey, have you looked at this? Anyway, it's always good to find out all the parts of the ecosystem and how they can work together better. So it has been an amazing ride through all of this, and none of this is the sort of thing I could have imagined for myself growing up on the farm back then. But then what about the Christian part? How did that happen? I mentioned that I didn't grow up in a home where faith was considered relevant. It wasn't denigrated, it just wasn't considered worth time. All the things my parents taught me about did not include any reading of the Bible. By the time I got to college, I was, I guess, an agnostic, although I don't think I knew the word. By the time I got to graduate school studying chemistry, I was an atheist. I had no use for anybody who was going to tell me there was anything worth paying attention to that you could not measure with scientific tools. That was just all superstition. But then, as you heard, I went to medical school. And I managed to maintain my atheism for the first couple of years of mostly classwork. And then, as a third-year student, you're out there taking care of patients in the inpatient wards of a hospital where everybody is really sick. And you're sitting at the bedside of good, honorable people who are not going to survive a whole lot longer. And you're imagining, what would I do in that situation? And I didn't like imagining that. And yet I saw some of my patients for whom their faith seemed to be such a strong anchor and gave them comfort and peace when our medicine wasn't doing that much. And I had to wonder about that. How does that work? And one afternoon, I was sitting at the bedside of a patient that I admit I'd gotten kind of attached to because she reminded me of my grandmother, who had really bad heart disease. And she had a bad episode of chest pain. And then she shared her faith with me in such an open, sincere way about how Jesus had made it possible for her to get through that without really being afraid. And then she looked at me after she had said this, and she said, "What do you believe, doctor?" She said, "You know, I've told you about my faith. This isn't even the first time, and you never say anything. What do you believe?" I'd never been asked that question. Not like that. Imagine for yourself right now if somebody asked you that question. I bet most of you would have an answer. I did not. And it bugged me that I did not. Suddenly my atheism felt very thin. And I think I stammered something like, "I don't really know." And I saw this look of surprise on her face. Like, "What? You're about to be a doctor and you've done all this studying and you don't really know?" Well, I couldn't let that go. I had to figure out some way to strengthen my atheism, so I better work harder at that. And you can tell it didn't quite turn out that way. So I began to ask people who were believers, who were scientists or physicians, "How did you get there?" And I was surprised to realize that some of the things I had studied as a scientist were actually part of their argument, that nature itself provides interesting pointers to God. I hadn't thought about that. What am I talking about? Well, the big one, there's something instead of nothing. Science doesn't help answer that. And then our universe, it wasn't always here, and it happened in an unimaginable singularity called the Big Bang, where out of nothing came our universe with all of its incredible size and magnitude, all flying apart, of matter and energy, tuned in a precise way so that it would end up with the right combination of matter and antimatter to have something solid and interesting happen. And then who was I as a scientist doing physical chemistry? I was in love with equations because that's how we described how matter and energy worked. Give me a second order differential equation and I'm going to have a great afternoon. And they worked. I mean, that's how quantum mechanics works. Why? The Nobel Prize-winning physicist's phrase, the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics to describe how the universe works. Doesn't that make you think there's a mind behind all this? I never thought about that. And even more, when you dig into this, and I didn't learn about this until I was pretty far along with this process, and then I was really blown away. Think about the way in which those equations describe matter and energy. Take gravity. Gravity, if you remember, I'm sure you all do, is an inverse square law. You have this mass and this mass. How much gravity is there between them? Well, it's mass 1 times mass 2 divided by r squared, the distance between them, times g. What the heck is g? G is a constant. It is the gravitational constant. You can't derive the value of that. You just have to measure it. Well, guess what? If it was off by even one part in a billion, being a little stronger, people have done this simulation, we would not be here because we would have had the Big Bang and things would have flown apart. But gravity being just that tiny bit stronger, they would have started to come back together. And there would be a big crunch before we all had a chance to show up. If gravity is a little bit weaker, on the other hand, then you have particles flying apart and there's not enough gravity to actually coalesce into stars and planets and us. And that's not the only one. There are a half dozen of these constants that have to have exactly the value that they do for anything interesting to happen in the universe. Otherwise, it's just completely sterile, nothing there. Okay, how can that be? You got two choices here. You can't just say, oh, that's coincidence. It's far too odd than that. Either there's an infinite number of other universes out there that have different values of the constant, and we're in this one, so we're the ones that got lucky, the multiverse hypothesis. Or you have to say there's a mind behind it that not only set up those equations, but set up the value of the constants and wanted something interesting to happen, which sounds like a creator God. Which of those two hypotheses requires greater faith? We'll never be able to measure those hypothesized multiverses. We can measure what we've got here. I was pretty compelled. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think that proves the existence of a creator God, but it certainly tips the balance, I would say, very strongly in the sense that there is an intelligence that made this all happen and wanted it to be interesting, right to the point of our being here to talk about it. That might have gotten me to deism. I'm telling you now sort of the arguments that made Einstein into a deist. Stephen Hawking would even be willing to say he probably could get along with deism because of these arguments from physics. But wait a minute, what about theism, where you not only say there's a creator God, but it's a great God that cares about you and me? That's another leap. Here I went down the street to talk to a pastor who I'd seen out mowing his lawn, and I thought maybe he could help me with this question about how is it that a reasonable person could actually believe in a creator God who cared about me. And we had an interesting conversation. I think most of my questions were blasphemous, but he was tolerant. And then he looked over at his collection of books and he thought, you know, maybe there's one of these that would help you. And he took that first one there on the right and he said, why don't you go home and read this and see if it speaks to you, because it's written by a guy who was traveling the same journey that you seem to be on, an Oxford scholar who was a skeptic. And of course, this was Mere Christianity. This was C.S. Lewis. And I was utterly stunned by even the first few pages of the book by this deeply thoughtful scholar who, in that first chapter called Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe, brought up what I had been missing, this concept of the moral law. Where does morality come from? I'd never thought about that. So it's just there. You have a sense of what's good and what's bad. And turns out all societies have. And sometimes it calls you to do stuff that is kind of a scandal to evolution. If you're actually called upon to try to save the life of somebody you don't even know who's in a different tribe, maybe even your enemy, and you feel that's what I'm supposed to do when somebody's out drowning in the river, I'm supposed to go and help them. Where is that coming from? Doesn't make a lot of sense in secular terms, but there it is. Now, don't get me wrong. Culture has a big impact on what you decide is in the good column and what's in the bad column. Our culture influences us even today about that. But we don't disagree that good and bad exist. And we don't disagree that we're supposed to be good, even when we're not. And when we're not, what do? We make an excuse. Well, I was tired. Well, she spoke to me badly first. It's only saying that we believe in the moral law and we have to make an excuse when we break it. Otherwise, we would just say, the heck with your moral law. And we don't do that. I find that very compelling. If you were looking somewhere in your own heart for an indication, a signpost, that God is not just a creator of the universe, but God cares about you, and you find this within yourself, this calling to be good and holy, that doesn't make scientific sense completely anyway, what is that about? It also says, of course, that God must be good and holy and expects us to be also. And then the other thing that captured me that I hadn't thought much about, but I'd certainly sought after in ways that I hoped I could find it sometimes, was beauty. Beauty doesn't always make sense either. Here's an example of beauty that a scientist can tell you about. There's two pictures, a rose window on the left. On the right, that's DNA again, except this time we're looking down the long axis, so you see this radial pattern. That's just exquisitely beautiful. And as a scientist, you get to have those moments of awe at beauty. But I don't know that that makes any particular sense outside of a connection to something outside of yourself, the numinous. You're touching something there. Well, long story. It took me 2 years to walk through these various arguments. And an important part of it was getting to the point of recognizing that the arguments about, particularly about morality, led me to the idea of a personal God, but also a God who is holy, and also made me realize I'm in trouble because I'm not really that holy. And if I'm just beginning to recognize the existence of a holy God, maybe about the only relationship we're going to have is going to be judgment, because that's probably what I deserve. And then into that somewhat deepening gloom came the bright light of Jesus Christ, who, of course, in a way that I had never understood, came to take upon himself the burden of my sins so that I could have that loving relationship with God the Father and not, despite my shortcomings, feel like it was only about judgment. No, it was about love. And all those phrases I had heard from people on the street corner about Jesus died for your sins and you need to be covered with the blood, it was like, what are you talking about? It suddenly made the most perfect sense. And so I was 27 when I finally, on a beautiful day, hiking in the northwest of this country, felt I could no longer resist. I could not prove that all this was true, but I sure couldn't go back. And I fell on my knees and I said, okay, I am yours. Please help me figure out how to live a new kind of life where that reality is going to be the real foundation of everything I want to do. And that was answered. And now here I am 49 years later, having found that foundation to be the solid rock that I can stand on, even in the midst of a complicated scientific debate. And I don't have to build a firewall between my faith perspective and my science perspective. They are working together on any given Thursday afternoon without any particular clash. Even though people said, oh, you're going to run into all kinds of conflicts, I never did. Maybe in part because I was lucky enough not to have had drummed into me as a child a few views about faith that you have to believe this thing in order to be a Christian. And some of those things, frankly, are not all that solid in the Bible, like how old is the earth? Science basically tells us the earth is 4.5 billion years old. You can't get away from that. But that was never a problem to me. I see how that fits with Genesis 1 quite comfortably when you read those words and you try to imagine, as John Walton has brilliantly written about in his book, The Lost World of Genesis 1, what those words meant to the first audience who read them and who certainly would have been appalled at the idea that this was supposed to be a scientific textbook describing 24-hour days. So yes, I've come to this conclusion that science and faith are actually not just okay, they can get along, they're allies. Let me say a little bit more about that. I think there are two ways of knowing. Science answers how questions, faith answers why questions. I like both of those questions. I don't want to have to skip over one or the other. I feel like I'm living an impoverished intellectual life. Francis Bacon, back in 1618, wrote about this as the two books that God gave us, the book of God's words, the Bible, and the book of God's works, which is nature. I love that. And they're both God's books. So as we get to read them, and scientists who are Christians get to read both of them, if we think there's a conflict, we've probably made a mistake in our reading, and we ought to figure out what went wrong there, because the author is the same. So this is no problem, right? Well, you all know, here we are. There's still lots of people who feel that this is an area of irreconcilable conflict. Some of it, I'm an evangelical Christian, some of it seems to be particularly the case in evangelical circles, and oftentimes it's about origins. A little cartoon here that might make you laugh or might not. Here is the never-ending debate between cheddar and evangelical goldfish crackers. And you can see the evangelical ones just appeared in the bag and the others came from cheese. So, okay, we can laugh about that. But it gets pretty intense. And I run all the time into young people who have been given a sense that in the story of origins, evolution can't be right because it threatens the foundations of their faith. I don't see it that way at all, but they are told that. And then they get to university and they find out the evidence behind evolution, which is right now just about as well supported as gravity, and it becomes very difficult for them to figure out what to do. BioLogos helps them a lot in that space, and BioLogos has a new initiative to reach out even more to young people. One of the things that has helped us about understanding all of this is actually science. And the study of genomes is one of them. So that was the first human genome described in this journal called Nature. And then in short order, we got the mouse genome, we got the chimpanzee genome, we got the dog genome, we got the honeybee genome, the sea urchin genome, the macaque genome, the platypus. I know you're waiting for that one. And of course, a computer can now look at those genomes and say, how are they related? And just looking at the sequence, the computer can basically put down an evolutionary tree, which maps right on top of what people had been assuming to be the case based on anatomical findings. So the coherence of the data is really compelling. But now, are humans part of this too? There's still some people who are uneasy about that. Well, again, the DNA information is worth looking at here. And let me just show you an example. When you look at the order of genes along a chromosome in different species, you find that in short distances, you often find the same set of genes in exactly the same order, which is pretty consistent with there having been a shared ancestor of some sort. So here are three genes that happen to be in that space between human, cow, and mouse. They're all kind of lined up like this. But I show you this one particularly because that one in the human, and all of us, has undergone a serious mutation. Part of it, the gene is just deleted. It's missing. And so GULO does not work in you and me. Even though it was in the same place in the cow and the mouse, something happened that it lost its function. So what is GULO? Well, that happens to be the critical gene that's necessary for you to make vitamin C. That's why the sailors got scurvy. That's why cows and mice don't get scurvy, because they can make vitamin C. It's a simple example, but I find it hard to look at that and not conclude that the human genome is also part of this tapestry of shared inheritance. If we were a separate enterprise, would God have actually gone to the trouble of putting a defective gene in the middle of this stretch just to kind of fool us into thinking that it really was evolutionarily related? That seems like the kind of thing God wouldn't do. And so I find the compelling evidence here that we are part of this amazing tapestry of development. And that is something that I can find quite comfortably to fit with my view of how we all got here and how it was all part of God's plan. And let me try that out on you. So let's start at the beginning. Almighty God, who's not limited in space or time, that's important because that's how you get around having the Big Bang out of nothing. God is not limited by space and time, so you don't have to say, well, then who created God? Because God doesn't need a creator. Created this universe 13.8 billion years ago with these parameters I mentioned precisely tuned to allow something interesting to happen, long periods of time, to us, not to God. God's original plan included the mechanism of evolution to create the diversity of living things on our planet. That was always in there. I think that's incredibly elegant. Most especially, that was to ultimately lead to human beings. And that involved preparation of a sufficiently advanced brain and the arrival of free will, consciousness, and the moral sense, all part of God's plan, and then ultimately arriving at the point of being made in God's image. We humans use our free will. to disobey God, leading to our realization of being in violation of the moral law, the fall. Thus, we became estranged from God, our Creator, who embodies all that is good, loving, and holy. But for Christians, as I learned in my search, Jesus Christ provides the solution to that estrangement. You can quibble, of course, about this particular very simple synthesis, but I find it very comfortable in terms of it's totally comfortable with what I know as a scientist, and I believe it is totally comfortable with what the Bible tells us about ourselves. So what could this be called? This is where this word biologos comes from. Bios is life, and it's through logos, the word. In the beginning was the word, John 1. Or more simply, just biologos, God speaking life into being. And I wrote about this in a book called The Language of God, which came out exactly 20 years ago, and then started this foundation that was already mentioned called Biologos, which again, I encourage you to have a look at, and I'll give you a QR code at the end if you don't know about them that you can grab it. So that was the part of this presentation, it's most of it, about how it is that I found my way from being a small boy on a farm in Virginia to becoming a scientist and also a follower of Christ. But now I do want to say a little bit about the current state of our nation and our world. And there's much more about that in the book that I'll be signing out there for those who are interested, called The Road to Wisdom. I think we all have to agree that we're in a difficult place right now, and particularly in the United States of America, although this same kind of polarization is afflicting other countries. By every measure, we seem to be in the worst of the state. There's a recent Pew survey that asked people, do you think your neighbors are morally bad? 57% of Americans said yes. We were the highest percentage of all 25 countries that they queried. Wow. What country was the lowest at only 7% thinking their neighbors were bad? It's not too far from here. It was Canada. Canadians can now feel really good about themselves. So what's happened? Well, we've gotten all polarized. More in Common is a group that has kind of tried to characterize the American society and breaks us down into 7 different categories. And it's true that most of us are in the middle, probably 2/3 of us in what they call the exhausted majority, and not into the mudslinging that is mostly what one sees, especially on social media. But it's the wings that get all the attention. And they basically get all of us fearful and anxious and angry, and we fall into that same trap. And also, it seems like it's more and more the case that it's not just enough that those people don't agree with me, that they might actually be kind of dangerous. And that if there's some argument about something, then I need to have my way come out right, or there's going to be a real threat to my whole society. There's a cartoon in The New Yorker, which I'm kind of amused by, but it's a little too close to the truth. These are two dogs in a bar, and one says to the other, it's not enough that we succeed. Cats must also fail. Does that sound like a political argument we're having right now, U.S. Congress? It's not enough. Yeah, there we go. And this has turned into, I think for us, not just an unfortunate kind of public contentious dialogue, it's really affecting our lives. It's even causing people to lose their lives. That was never more apparent to me than during COVID. So let's say for a minute about the vaccines that were developed for SARS-CoV-2. What do we know for sure? Well, they were developed and tested in record time, 11 months, never before in less than 5 years. I was deeply engaged in the design of these double-blind randomized trials that enrolled 30,000 volunteers who did not know if they were getting the vaccine or a dummy shot. And then we watched over months to see who got sick and who didn't. And serious side effects for those 30,000 people for both the Moderna and the Pfizer mRNA vaccines were quite rare. And they were 92 to 95% effective in preventing serious disease or hospitalization. That was with the original virus. Now you may say, well, wait a minute, it's not that good. It's not as good now because the virus has mutated and also the vaccine wanes over time. But it's still the case that if you got vaccinated and you got COVID this past winter, your chance of ending up in the hospital was less than half of what it would have been if you weren't vaccinated. So it's still providing significant benefit even after all of this. There's general agreement that in the United States alone, about 3 million lives were saved by these vaccines. We don't know who they were. I might have been one of them. You might have been one of them. If you actually are here and you got vaccinated, this might be the reason you're here. And yet, this is the saddest number that I've seen in a long time. Kaiser Family Foundation did this work, and I think their methods are completely reliable, in concluding that more than 230,000 people who were unvaccinated died unnecessarily after vaccines were freely available. Think of all those graveyards that didn't have to be there because we didn't trust each other. We got into various camps about what's true, what's not true. Conspiracy theories were all over the place about chips in the syringe, or it's going to make you sterile, or some that I couldn't even remember. And yet, people believed them, and distrust in science began to grow, and has grown steadily since then. And I'm sorry to say that this has influenced politicians in ways that are also truly unfortunate. The U.S. government, because of stories about mRNA vaccines that are not based on truth, is now discouraging the development of that whole kind of technology if we have a future pandemic. And this would be our best way of responding if another pandemic came along, and it's now not going to happen in the U.S. It will in China. And that's purely on political grounds. This is not the way a sophisticated technological society should be handling questions of this sort. So how do we get here? I think we've lost some traditional anchors that we used to depend on, and I think we can get them back, but we got to first do the diagnosis and say what happened. First of all, truth. Objective truth is really important, and it's not okay to say, oh, well, might be true for you, but it's not true for me just because you don't like the fact. Facts don't care how you feel, and it seems increasingly that people feel okay about saying, I don't like that fact, so I don't have to believe it. Truth has various versions, of course. I'm kind of fond of this concentric circle version, where there are things right in the center that have to be truth. 2 + 2 = 4. And then outside of that, there are firmly established facts that science has shown us. By the way, the Earth is round and not flat. There are thousands of people who belong to the Flat Earth Society. That's not a good thing. And then outside that, there's a circle of uncertainty, things we're still working on. That's great. Let's work on them. Some of them, maybe we'll figure out how to move into the zone of firmly established facts. And then further out, there's opinion. An opinion is great. It doesn't threaten anything if you don't agree with my opinion about a movie. But the problem we often have now is we get into a discussion and we forget which circle we're in. And then it becomes okay to have a person basically say about a firmly established fact, well, I don't believe that anymore. Okay, if that's your claim, your evidence has to be really strong. Scientists, by the way, love to do that. You make your name as a scientist when you blow up a firmly established fact. But it doesn't happen very often. And for you to actually do that, you can't just have a feeling about it. You've got to have real data. So this is one of our areas, I think, that has gotten into real trouble. Truth matters. And it seems okay now for lies to be spread, including by elected officials, without any real consequence. It's just like, oh, well, that's kind of the way we are now. We can't go on that way for very long. Science is all about developing hypotheses, doing experiments. Depends on replication, makes mistakes, but they are ultimately self-correcting because any scientific claim that matters is going to be tested by other people. And if it's wrong, you'll figure that out. So it is a reliable way to discover the truth about nature. That's my lab at NIH, or it was my lab until a year ago when I was made unwelcome. And those wonderful folks are still laboring away, discovering new things about diabetes and aging. And I think we are, as I mentioned earlier, in a difficult place here where science is actually also subject to distrust. And the results of that have led to a cutting back in support for medical research. Our U.S. medical research record is stunning. I told you about some of those things earlier on, but it's really in trouble with budgets cut, staff being fired, universities in many instances being hit with $1 billion of money that they thought they were going to get for grants that they had received that's being held back for reasons that don't have much to do with the research. And I think most Americans aren't really aware this is happening, and this has now become a passion of mine, is to try to figure out how to get that word out there. So this Discovery Lives in Us will be getting launched in another month or two. It is something I'm putting together with two or three other folks to try to just tell stories of patients whose lives have been profoundly benefited by medical research and want you to know about it, and also want you to understand it didn't just happen by good luck. Oftentimes, like that cystic fibrosis story, it took years of incredible hard work to ultimately get to that breakthrough. And if we start pulling the plug, the breakthroughs are not going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years. And then faith. We did truth, we did science. What about faith? Again, faith answers for me questions that science can't help with. Does God exist? Does God care about me? What happens after I die? I need to understand answers to that. And faith at a storm like this should be an anchor. Christians ought to be in the best position to be advocates against all this divisiveness and in favor of love, grace, and truth. But as I see it, there's still a lot of Christian communities where it's really hard to have those conversations, that our churches have also gotten caught up in a lot of the polarized messages, many of them political, that is the opposite of what the Sermon on the Mount would call us to. In terms of loving not just your neighbors, you got to love your enemies. How are we doing on that? That's not so popular these days. And yet, that's what we're called to do. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. And then you will know the truth if you hold to Jesus' teaching. And Matthew 25, which is a particular important chapter that BioLogos has been focused on the last few months, is this one. Whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. We have a compassion deficit right now in our country, and it's reflected in our losing this thread. The least of these, those in prison, those who are hungry, those who are naked, those who are sick, that we are supposed to focus our efforts on. Too often, it seems, we have othered them. And then the fourth issue, trust. Trust is eroding across the board in every institution over the course of the last 40 years or so. The only one that's gone up a little bit is the military. Everything else has gone down. I mean, dramatically down. Some of that is earned, but some of it is just our own skepticism and cynicism, and some of it's manufactured distrust by people who are trying to tear down institutions, and we're somehow believing their claims when they're not true. How do we fix this? Well, first of all, how do you decide who to trust? I thought about that for myself, and I think there's sort of four areas that when somebody makes a claim or an institution does, that I'm kind of mentally checking out. Is this a source with integrity? Are they honest? Are they competent? Have they done the work? Or are they just posting something on the internet? Are they humble? Do they admit they don't know everything? That's kind of important. Be wary of somebody who has the answers to all things, because that's not humility and it's probably not reliable. But then there's that fourth one. Does that source align with my values? Which seems reasonable. But in our polarized system, where we're so focused on our tribe, and we are, let's be honest, and that other tribe over there, we don't know about them, and we probably don't trust them, then we can really be misled by picking something that's coming at us from our tribe and not being sufficiently careful about whether it has integrity and competence and humility, and just saying, yeah, it must be true, those are my people. And if it's coming from that other tribe over there that we don't trust, you may ignore something that was absolutely perfect truth you needed to know, but it was them, so I'm going to discount it. Aligned values has kind of taken over. That's another part of what's happened to us. Well, okay, enough of the diagnosis and sounding kind of gloomy. I don't think really we need to be gloomy. I think we can find our way back. But I don't think it's going to come from the politicians. And I don't think it's going to come from the media. What could we do? I think, first of all, as Christians, people of faith, people who have a foundation, we need to re-anchor ourselves to that. A lot of what's going around these days is not what you would read in the words of Jesus in Matthew 25 or Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount. So trying to step back from the other distractions and re-anchor to those timeless principles. And do a better job, all of us need to. I'm always working at this and sometimes failing to distinguish the facts from the fakes. And again, be careful about those things that came at you from people who seem to be in your tribe, but sometimes they can be wrong too. And social media and cable news are oftentimes not your friend. And then here's an exhortation. This church, I gather from Tim, has done a great job of keeping people here who are across the spectrum in your different views, politically and about society. A lot of churches have not succeeded at that. And even within a church that's still holding together, there are probably people that you're not sure you really want to talk to because you know they have that opinion and that's not how you feel. Wouldn't we be doing something good if we try to begin to reach out beyond those bubbles and actually call up somebody who you used to talk to before you got on the wrong side of an issue? Say, let's have coffee, and I want you to tell me why you feel the way you do about that issue. Maybe it's gun control or immigration or something like that. And then really listen. Listen to understand. Ask questions. Don't listen to try to come up with your snappy response. And then they will listen to you. And it's amazing what can start to happen in that circumstance, because you begin to understand, where is that person coming from, instead of just immediately discounting their perspective. I learned a lot about this from Braver Angels. I'm curious. How many people here have ever been to a Braver Angels meeting? I see a few hands. Okay, I'm going to do some recruiting right now. If you don't know about Braver Angels, look it up. This is an organization that's been around now since 2016, and it brings people together on opposite sides of an issue, and in a moderated discussion, where you have to remain civil, but you can speak your mind, people actually have to listen to each other. Here's some pictures of that. Down in the lower right-hand corner is me listening to Wilk Wilkinson, who's a guy who until a year ago ran a trucking company here in Minnesota. And let's just say he had different views about how COVID public health decisions were made than what actually happened. And the first couple of times we met, it was really hard to listen to his very strong views about the mistakes that had been made. But I began to understand why, from his perspective in a rural community in Minnesota, a lot of the things that were being done that made sense in New York really didn't. And we didn't have the time or the staff or the expertise really to try to do this in a more precise way. But it was harmful in communities like his. And I needed to know that. I needed to hear that. And he needed, I think, to hear from me about why the decisions were made they were, and that there was nobody's effort here to try to do harm. We were all just trying to save lives. Braver Angels is a great place. If you have time to go into one of their meetings, you will learn a lot about how to actually listen and understand, and we need a lot more of that. And then take that back and forth, one-on-one. See if you can build that into community opportunities. Churches are a good place. Book clubs, other kinds of gatherings where you're not afraid to talk about issues that are a bit contentious. And yeah, it would help if our national leaders would also model some of this, where compromise would be considered a virtue instead of a sin. And then one thing I might even ask you to do, if you felt in any way some sense that this might be something you'd want to take part in, think about making a commitment that you're going to be part of this. Starting tonight, I want to be part of figuring out how to get us beyond our divisive, grievance-laden state. And one at a time, I'm going to be part of the solution. And that would mean a pledge. Now, there is a QR code if you want to go to the actual pledge, which is on the Braver Angels website, and see the whole thing. This is a shorthand version of it. But I think you can see what the idea is. I want to be part of the solution. I want to reach out to people who don't agree with me. I want to be more careful about what I consume and what I spread around to other people. And I'm going to really work on loving my neighbor in a generous way to all my interpersonal interactions. If we could start to do that, maybe just one at a time, every good thing that's ever happened kind of starts that way. Maybe we in this amazing United States of America could begin to turn ourselves back around. So a lot of what I've said was about this question of how do we get wisdom, and a lot of it requires, I think, these serious considerations about truth, science, faith, and trust, and how to get them back on track. But if you really want to get wisdom, don't ask me. Go to the book of James. This is decorated by my daughter, who's a physician artist. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it will be given him. James chapter 1, verse 5. I love that when I'm really lost and I don't know what I'm doing. God will give me without reproach this kind of wisdom. And then James 3, verse 17 goes on to tell you, well, how would you recognize that wisdom? Well, it's first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering and without hypocrisy. That's what we're looking for. Some other kinds of wisdom, unfortunately, occasionally masquerade. So I hope this has been helpful as a bit of a personal biography of my travels through science and faith, but then a reflection on where we are as a community, particularly people of faith, on how we might reflect on our circumstances and see if we can anchor ourselves back to what the Bible is calling us to. And I appreciate your attention, and I'm now going to look forward to hearing your questions.
There will be a chance for questions in a moment, as I mentioned, as he offered here. Before then, let me make a few announcements, if I might. As I said, this is the final event in this year's season. We're hard at work on scheduling next year's season. If you'd like to know more about dates for that, I'd encourage you to sign up for our various emails and social media. You can find all of that on the Faith and Life website. I mentioned there's no real theme each year other than finding amazing speakers. Next year, we seem to be gravitating towards a theme of at least a few Minnesota speakers, though, which is a little unusual. We very rarely actually bring speakers from the state, so we'll see how it all pans up, but we'll likely have at least a majority of speakers from Minnesota. So again, please look for information about that. That'll start, by the way, in the fall, probably the month of October. Then if I could just take a moment again at the end of this season to say thank you to a few people, beginning with our sponsors. Again, you've heard this already. This is the end of our 23rd season. And while this is a community service of this particular congregation, it is not paid for by the budget of this church. It is covered, the expenses and costs are covered entirely by the generosity of series sponsors. And that's been true from the very first year. I'm profoundly grateful for all the individuals and organizations who make this series possible. And I'll lift up some of the corporate sponsors here: Crossroads Financial Group, Savills, Mally Design, Rotation Engineering, Bay Creek Dental, Mastercraft Labels, Productivity Inc., Rapid Packaging, and the Valuation Group. And you see the names of many others who also support the series. Many of those individuals who represent those organizations or the individuals themselves are here tonight or watching online. Will you join me in thanking them? I want to say also thanks to Subtext Bookstores, who, as Dr. Collins mentioned, will be selling the book, The Road to Wisdom, in the lobby of the Narthex, so you can pick up a copy after that and have him inscribe it. So thank you, Subtext, for your partnership. I also want to say thank you. Normally, I would be saying thank you to a gentleman named Jeff Elstad, who is our guitarist for before and after each of these events. Jeff has been with us from the very beginning of our series. Tonight, we are privileged to have his son, Eli. Where are you, Eli? Oh, he's back there, Eli. So Jeff's son, Eli, thank you. And the final person I'm gonna say, give a shout out to, It's Shelley, right? Yeah. Shelley, who was sitting in the front row here, arrived at the church at 4:30, which I think breaks a record for the earliest attendee for one of these events. So give a hand to Shelley. All right, so we're going to take just a few minutes for some questions. We'll maybe, let's call it maybe 5 or 10 minutes for questions. If you have further ones, you can visit with Dr. Collins afterwards. So I will invite you back up. And again, mics to my right and my left. And as another person who leads one of these series says, please use the proper punctuation at the end of your statement. In other words, a question mark, not a period.
Yes.
Thank you for your lecture, Doctor. It was fantastic. So when you were mentioning the human genome, we're learning more and more about the human being, and you mentioned the brain. And as you're talking at the end of your piece about the current state of our country, I heard about the brain, and as we gain more information about how the brain works, I thought, do I really want that? Do I really want human beings to know how the brain works? So I'm wondering, in this field of study, can you tell us about any ethical boards that kind of put the safety curbs around the studies? And if there are such boards, your opinion, are they going to be effective? Or once the information is out there, could it be misused for nefarious purposes? And then secondly, a little bit more of an upper question, is there any study right now in the field that really excites you?
I don't know where to start with that because there's so many. So the Brain Initiative has in fact taken very seriously these questions about ethics. If we are starting to understand how circuits in the brain work, and in fact we're actually sometimes implanting electrodes in the brain for people with Parkinson's disease or sometimes depression because it helps, but does that mean those people are losing some of their privacy? Are those kinds of technologies actually going to be able to invade your very thoughts? We don't think so yet, but that's something you really ought to be thinking about. We're also doing with stem cells the circumstance where I could take a blood sample from you, turn it into a stem cell, and then differentiate that stem cell into a variety of different types of brain cells and turn it into a brain organoid that has various layers of the brain. All that came from that one cell that I got out of your blood. So it's still you, but what kind of ethical stance should we take about that? What's the dignity question there when you start to get to something that has that sort of complexity? We're not to the point yet where I think anybody's worried that those organoids have consciousness, but we don't really know what consciousness is. And then the whole idea of being able, sort of in a science fiction way, to recognize memory, we're beginning to learn how that works, and capture it, and maybe even implant it in somebody else's brain. That sounds really scary, like the kind of thing that we probably shouldn't be doing unless there was a really compelling medical reason to do so. So I just want to reassure you, there is a lot of smart, thoughtful, ethical people looking, trying to stay ahead of this and not sort of getting to a crisis. But I would say, balanced against that, and we should pay attention to that, we're also making, I think, a lot of progress in areas that are going to help people who are really suffering. And particularly, I think of a condition like schizophrenia, which is 1% of the population for which we really don't have great solutions. And clearly, there are circuit problems there. And if we can figure out something to do for those folks, then we should push as hard as we can. But yeah, thanks for the question. In terms of great, exciting things that I'm right now, I can Fess, I am so excited about the ability with those thousands of rare genetic diseases to be able to cure those with this gene editing approach. As I mentioned, the kids with progeria, which my lab is trying right now, and maybe in the first part of next year or maybe in the end of this year, we'll have the first patient that we will try to see if this could work. That's just breathtaking. Already working for sickle cell disease, what about those thousands of other diseases? That would be such a triumph. Yes.
Thank you for a beautiful talk. I'm a research scientist. I run a lab, and I get most of my funding from the NIH. And as you described, the NIH funding landscape has changed a lot in the last year. I had a grant that was a 5-year grant. It was terminated after the first year last year. And I have graduate students in my lab. I talk to undergrads who are interested in going into science. What's your advice? How can I stay positive about where NIH funding and scientific research is going? Because I really try to stay positive for the trainees in my lab, but it can be difficult when, you know, I keep getting grant rejections and the NIH funding landscape is just very concerning.
I totally hear you, and I am also deeply troubled about the state we're in and its effect, particularly on young scientists. I just spent the last 2 days at a diabetes research meeting at the University of Michigan, and the room was full of graduate students and postdocs who are doing amazing work in this space. But to a person, they're wondering, is there a path forward for them with so many things now being so uncertain and so many cuts happening? I think there are some reasons to see that this is starting to look more encouraging. The Congress of the United States has basically rejected the proposals of dramatic cuts in the NIH budget and have stood up for that. There are other things that haven't been fixed yet, so it's still really hard to get a grant funded, and an awful lot of grants got stopped for no good reason, including grants on cancer and Alzheimer's disease and lots of other things. But our cause is so compelling. That this is about saving lives and making discoveries, and it's also the best support of the American economy of anything we've done since World War II, is science. That's how our economy has grown. So there's no really good argument here for not bringing this back together. And I think the pendulum is starting to swing back again in a more healthy way. And then it'll give us a chance maybe to build something even better. Somebody said in our meeting yesterday, nostalgia is not a strategy. So we have to be careful we're not spending all of our time telling the kids, oh, in the old days. No, we can build something even better. And I think we will. I really have that confidence. And I'm comfortable saying to a young scientist, hang in there. This will find its way forward. And history will look at this as an aberration. We'll get this to work. But thank you for asking. Over here.
Oh, what's your view in general about cloning of organs, hearts, lungs, kidneys, liver? Are we getting close, and should we be working on that? Because there's implications. You're cloning, you know, part of a person, like the question on the brain.
Yeah. And everything. Yeah, so there is effort underway. Again, I talked about stem cells that you can make a brain organoid. You could also make a kidney from somebody who might need one. Or you could make a heart. This is not quite there yet. It's not quite ready to be done in the average hospital, but it's starting to make progress. I think that's actually pretty exciting. I don't see that as horrendously ethically challenging, that you're basically taking your own cells and instead of doing a transplant from somebody else, which means you have a completely new kind of genome in your body, it's still yours, but you've had to make it by this way. You want to be sure it's safe. You want to be sure it works. That's the big challenge there. And that won't be trivial. But I think that part is probably something that we can be excited about and try to support. And it is being worked on for kidneys and hearts especially. But that won't be the end of it. And probably in 10 years, we may see something like that actually come to pass. Over here.
What does it actually look like to find the cause of a genetic disorder? Do you have to go through the entire genome to find them usually? Or do you have markers to look at the symptoms and figure out where it might be?
What a great question. In the old days, we had to use markers because we couldn't look at the whole genome. It was much too hard and too expensive. So cystic fibrosis that I told you about, which took us 5 years to get to the answer, first you had to figure out which chromosome is it on by studying a lot of families and saying, is there some variable part of DNA that predicts who got this in those families? It must be close to the gene. And those markers were really helpful when it was all we had. But now, if you were a graduate student and we hadn't discovered cystic fibrosis, and I gave you, you know, a couple dozen DNA samples of people who had it and a couple dozen who didn't, and you had a DNA sequencer, you just sequence them all. And you figure out, oh, it's that three base pair thing. What was so hard about that? So, yet the technology has evolved so dramatically. It's a great question.
I know we have people standing on both sides. I think we're going to do, I'm going to call last question. I apologize, but I feel a burden of responsibility for your time. So, Shelley, since you were here at 4:30, you have the privilege of the last question.
Thanks again, Dr. Collins. When I was 10 years old, I asked for a microscope, and I have loved biology ever since. Genetics is my current passion. And my question is, you know, for many decades, scientists, healthcare workers, public health workers, they were revered people. And now there's a lot of mistrust, misinformation. It's really disheartening. People in my own life who I love dearly don't really trust or believe what I tell them when I, you know, learn something. So do you think the tide will turn, or what can we do as scientists? I know that's a big question, but...
No, it's a big, big question, Shelley, and one that I think all of us in the medical profession are struggling with, that what used to be an assumption that you were going to share people information that was reliable is now often not considered that. And it's part of that trend that I showed you of that terrible slide with all of the trust figures falling off to the left side across all institutions, and that's been science as well. It does call upon all of us to be patient and spend more time explaining the basis of something that we are trying to convince somebody they might want to use as a decision maker, and not just say, trust me, because I know. You're going to have to get past that. And sometimes you don't have the time to do that. Pediatricians now spend so much of their time just trying to explain the value of vaccines, because so many people are now triggered to be skeptical on the basis of things they have heard, even though vaccines are probably one of the most amazing things we've ever done as a human species, all the way up to and including the COVID-19 vaccines. But still, there's this undercurrent of suspicion, much of it based upon things that just aren't true. And then the pediatricians have to go through that all again. And believe me, they're frustrated, but I think they're doing the right thing by basically listening. Where did you get that information? Tell me the basis of what you have heard. Let's talk about that. So, and scientists, I think, also have to be better communicators maybe than we thought we had to be in the past. This effort that I mentioned called Discovery Lives in Us is supposed to be a small effort in that space to put in front of people patients who have gone through amazing experiences because of science, and some young scientists as well who can talk about their dreams of what they want to achieve, like the one who was asking us a question a minute ago, so the public can really see, oh, this matters. This is substantive. This isn't some rumor that came out of my social media feed. This really matters.
So I'm now going to stand up and say thank you to Dr. Collins. Normally, this would be the very last thing we do, but I talked to him on a Zoom call a couple weeks ago, and he had an idea, which he'll do in a moment. But before I let him explain that, thank you all for being here tonight for the end of this year's season. Thank you for those of you who join us digitally. By the way, we did get a lot of questions online tonight. We weren't able to get to those. I apologize. That's one of the challenges of running these series is lots of good questions and never enough time. So thank you all for being here. And Dr. Collins, it has been a joy to host you. We have a small gift for you. It's a granite plaque. It says, with thanks to Francis Collins for bringing faith to life. We're so grateful for your presence. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
I mentioned that among Dr. Collins' quirks were he rides a motorcycle, and he doesn't like spicy food. He also plays the guitar. This particular guitar has a name. And he'd like to join us all or lead us all in something. And Dr. Collins, your call, but at our church, we would typically stand for something like this. So is that okay if we do? And you can explain it. And after we're done with this, by the way, sorry, one stage direction thing. If you all could stay in your pews while Dr. Collins and I make our way from here to back there so that he can talk to you personally and sign your books. Otherwise, he will get stuck here and never get out. Okay, so part the Red Sea and allow him to get out after he's done with this.
So there's a wonderful lyricist named Thomas Troeger, who's also a pastor in Colorado, died about a year ago, just wrote some amazing hymn lyrics, but he always picks a tune that everybody knows, so you don't have to teach the tune. So I'm going to ask you all to sing this with me, because you will probably know the tune, many of you will anyway. And what is it about? It's about exactly what we've been talking about tonight, which is faith and learning. And what's the source? Well, that's God. So maybe I will get you to stand up if you don't mind. I've been sitting down a long time. Harmony would be fine if anybody finds an urge to do that. So here we go. Praise the source of faith and learning that has sparked and stoked the mind with a passion for discerning how the world has been designed. Let the sense of wonder flowing from the wonders we survey keep our faith forever growing and renew our need to pray. God of wisdom, we partial truth.